Hi, Peter.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Pretty good, thank you.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, and this is The Wright Show. You are Peter Singer. You've been described as the world's most famous philosopher, the world's most influential philosopher. You're often at Princeton, but you also teach in Melbourne, the University of Melbourne. And right now, in fact, I think you are down under in Australia. Is that
I
right?
am indeed in Melbourne at the moment. That's correct, yes.
Okay. Now I want to talk about largely today your book, The Most Good You Can Do. Now I am reading the Kindle version, so I can't hold up a regular copy of the book, but I think the cover would look just the way it does on my smartphone. If you've got a real physical copy, you want to. Well, this will be a test
I have a physical copy.
of your self-promotional
In fact,
instincts. Oh, they're in
I
good
have two.
shape.
If your viewers are interested in the Australian edition, we have a completely different cover design in Australia. They can vote
They
whether
can
which one they
choose,
like better.
or
They can
buy,
do.
or they can buy both and give one to a friend, which leads us to what the book is about. It's about giving people stuff in a certain sense. The subtitle is "How Effective Altruism Is Changing Ideas About Living Ethically." The key phrase is "effective altruism," which, as it suggests, is about how to do a good job of doing good, you might say, right? Or how to do good efficiently, if you're donating money to a charity, for example, or want to do good for other human beings in any sense. So that's kind of the topic, but the phrase isn't just about the process of figuring out how to do effective altruism. It also refers to a movement, right? There is now an effective altruism movement.
That's right, yes. And it's pretty new. Definitely didn't exist 10 years ago. In fact, I think the term effective altruism is probably less than 5 years old. But there are now a number of groups calling themselves effective altruism groups or chapters. There's websites, and there are a lot of people who consider themselves part of this movement. Mostly fairly young, people in their 20s or early who've decided that this is an important part of the way they want to live, and they want to spread the ideas of effective altruism and build up the movement.
There's a big, a pretty robust chapter, I think, at Harvard, and in fact, the son of a friend of mine is involved in it there, and he was just kind of going on and on about it. It was hard to get him to stop talking about effective altruism, Peter, and I think we may have you to partly thank for that. I mean, you have become de facto, I don't know what term, somewhere on the spectrum between guru and figurehead, but you're very prominently identified with the movement, even though you didn't kind of set out in a very self-conscious way to build it, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I guess I've had a couple of different roles. One is that way back in the 1970s, I wrote this article called Famine, Affluence, and Morality, which is one of my first academic publications. And it got reprinted in a lot of philosophy anthologies that were used for classroom teaching. A lot of professors used it to in applied ethics courses and challenged their students with it. So a lot of people have come across that article, and it has played a role in the thinking of some of the people who then did go ahead and organize and set up the movement. Then back in 2009, I published a book called The Life You Can Save, which wasn't explicitly an effective altruism work, but it was about global poverty and how relatively easy it is for people in the affluent world to make important contributions to the lives of people in extreme poverty. So that also played a role, and I suppose, and the movement has come up to some extent influenced by that. And then now I've got the new book out, so I've been in touch with people in the movement, the people who are setting it up, basically since they began doing that around 2007.
And I think one point of that first paper you referred to was that, in theory, if you want to be optimally ethical, you should keep giving away money until you get to the point where the kind of increment of good that the money does the person you give it to is equal to the decrease in the increment of your own welfare by virtue of losing the money. Did I put that right? It's a little complicated, but...
Yeah, no, I think you put that right. Yeah, till the point at which, you know, there's no further marginal utility in your making the donation, because the amount of good that you do to the other person is equally balanced with the amount of harm you do to yourself. Mm-hmm. But I think what's important is that you said that's the kind of optimum level. I didn't, even in that article, and some people might say I was more radical and demanding in that article than I am now, but even in that article, I didn't say, you know, if you don't do that, you're a terrible person, or that's the only standard to consider. I did suggest a more modest standard, where, you know, I basically said something like, if it's nothing, not comparable in any way, if the sacrifice you'd be making is not comparable to the good you'd be doing, mm-hmm. then you should be prepared to do it. So that's a more modest standard than the one that you described.
And even you give away about a third of your income, I think, but by your own account, you haven't gotten that far. You haven't gotten to the point of where the margins are equal. But giving a third of your income away, I've got to say, is impressive. Although I've actually encountered you on a number of occasions and you've never given me any money.
Just reduce yourself to a level of extreme poverty. You know, once you're on...
I am well on the way.
Today, Bob, I'll give you some.
I am on that path. I used to make a living as a writer, and I assure you I'm on that path, Peter. So I may be in touch down the road. So this idea of kind of the marginal return on altruistic investment, you might say, is suggestive of how kind of precisely quantitative you can, at least in theory, get with this in determining how to expend your energy and your resources altruistically. But before we get into examples of people doing that and doing a good job of it by your lights, why don't we start at the other end and talk about people who do a bad job of it? There are some examples in your book of what you consider very, very spectacularly inefficient altruism, right?
Sure. I mean, there are a number of different examples that we can give, but I talk, for example, about donating to a museum or art gallery, constructing a new wing of a gallery, and I look at some of the figures of what it costs to put a new wing onto the or to renovate the Museum of Modern Art in New York, or the Metropolitan Museum, which is considering a new wing. And I try to compare that with the amount of good that money could do in other places. Because, you know, I do this because a lot of people in the philanthropy field, I quote some of them, say, look, there's no objective basis for choosing one cause rather than another. You know, you should follow your passion. You should do whatever it is that seems good to you. Mm-hmm. And I try and argue that, you know, really, if you think about the amount of good that these kinds of donations will do, you can't really say that they're doing anything like as much good as you could do if you, instead of improving the museum, you helped a lot of people who are blind to see, for example, which is something you can do quite cheaply because there are millions of people in developing countries who suffer from cataracts and who are blind because they have cataracts. It's a very simple operation to remove cataracts. But because these people are poor, because they live in a country that has no free healthcare, they remain blind for decades, perhaps, that we could help. So just comparing how much good you could do there with the museum example, mm-hmm. I think makes it clear that there are objective criteria by which you can say some forms of philanthropy are better than others.
And wouldn't that imply, I mean, if you can indeed prevent blindness with well under $100, which I think you can, a single case of blindness, and you can probably save a life in certain cases for, I don't know, $1,000 or $2,000 or something, is that in the clear-cut cases?
That's probably in the right ballpark, yeah. The figures are, yeah.
I mean, doesn't that suggest that in a certain sense all philanthropy devoted to the arts is, by your lights, money misspent?
Yeah, that's probably true the way the world is at the moment, I think. And, you know, a lot of people then start talking about the importance of the arts and how strong the urge to express yourself artistically is. And I don't deny that. But, you know, again, you said it in precisely the right way. Money devoted to the arts. I don't think that people would stop expressing themselves artistically if they were not paid for it. And in fact, obviously, there's lots of cultures where people do express themselves artistically and they're not paid for it. Prisoners in concentration camps express themselves artistically and were not paid for it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think this would continue. And let me just say, I also think that we ought to preserve the cultural heritage that we have. So I'm not saying that we should allow the Metropolitan Museum to fall into disrepair so that the roof leaks and the paintings in it get damaged by the rain. You know, I mean, I'm not that much of a Philistine. I do think that we need to protect these works, but I don't think we need to really acquire more of them at the moment. I don't think that we need to, well, give another more recent example, too recent for my book. David Geffen has given $100 million to renovate what used to be called the Avery Fisher Concert Hall at the Lincoln Center. Maybe it still is called that, but it's soon going to be called the David Geffen Concert Hall. Mm-hmm. You know, again, I think you could enjoy music and music could be performed without it being performed in the absolutely best acoustically renovated concert halls.
Mm-hmm. And he could have cured a million people of blindness or something like that, right?
Yes, I think that's a very reasonable estimate, yeah.
And that does put it in pretty stark terms. And as long as we're getting you in trouble with people, another example you bring up is the Make-A-Wish Foundation, where I think they spend an average of $7,000 or $8,000, you know, taking a sick kid, usually terminally ill, I think, and making some single wish come true. And again, you're saying if you think about what you could do for those $7,000 or $8,000, as poignant as it is and wonderful as it is for that one day, for that one kid, you could do a lot more with that money.
Exactly. I mean, you know, any parent would say if given a choice between saving the child's life or making the child's wish come true for one day, they would say, please save my child's life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's pretty clear that for $7,000 or $8,000, you can save the life of more than one child. Mm-hmm. So that makes it even clearer, I think, that... And this is an example where, you know, things are expensive because they're done in the United States in an affluent country. And you can't save a child's life for $7,000 or $8,000 in the United States. But certainly if you go to developing countries where children die from preventable or curable diseases like malaria, measles, diarrhea, and so on, then you can.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, your book has a lot of examples of what you consider money well spent or people's energies well spent. Why don't you give us just one example of a person you would call an effective altruist?
Right. Well, one of the people I talk about in my book was, in fact, one of my Princeton students, a guy called Matt Wager, who was a very good philosophy student, got the philosophy department's prize for the best senior thesis in his final year, and was offered a place to do graduate work at good universities, including Oxford, pretty tempting invitation. But he had been thinking about how he could do the most good in his future career. And he also had prospects of getting much better paid positions on Wall Street, because in part, I think, because he had some math in his background as well. So he decided that he would be able to do more good that way. And within a year of graduating, he was able to donate a six-figure sum to effective charities. Basically, that was around half of his earnings. So he was already earning very well, but he was also resisting the temptations of saying, you know, now that I've got this money, I need to live in an expensive Tribeca penthouse, or I need to buy a Porsche or something like that. He was still living pretty modestly and was able to do, I think, an immense amount of good because he carefully chose the charities that he was donating to, and that would have saved many lives or done a lot of other good.
Mm-hmm. And you even make the argument that, although some people might say he should have gone into the nonprofit sector, gotten a job at an NGO, done charitable work himself, you make the argument that actually, no, his energies are probably better spent making a ton of money on Wall Street and putting a significant fraction of it into charity because, you know, if he doesn't, the job he would have taken in an NGO will be occupied by someone who will probably be roughly as good at it as he is. Whereas if he doesn't do this Wall Street thing, it's not like the person who takes his job on Wall Street is likely to donate $100,000 a year or whatever.
Right, exactly. And that's very characteristic of effective altruism thinking, because the point is, you know, what difference does my decision make? I really want to calculate where I'm going to have this impact. And if somebody else could have done the job with an NGO pretty much as well as I would have, then my decision to do that isn't going to make a big difference in the world. Whereas if I can give that money that would not otherwise have been given, that does make a bigger difference.
Okay. So once somebody is giving money, and you also give examples of people who are making much less money, doing what they would have done in any event, just following their career instincts or whatever, but still commit a sizable fraction of it to charity. Once you've made any such commitment, the question still arises as to how you spend the money. Who do you give the money to, right? And that's a certain amount of what you talk about. How do you go about answering that question?
Yeah, and there's two ways in which you can think about that question. One is, what cause do I choose? So do I, for example, we've been talking about global poverty, and that is a very big cause that probably is by far the biggest single cause that effective altruists would be concerned about. But some people will be concerned about the suffering of non-human animals. I've myself written a lot about that and been concerned about that. Some people may be concerned about problems like climate change, which affect both humans and animals. Some people are concerned about the risk of human extinction, about the idea that for one reason or another, we will wipe ourselves out, or perhaps an asteroid will collide with a planet and wipe us out. And is this something that we should be thinking about? So there's that issue, which effective altruists refer to as cause prioritization. What causes do we give priority to? And then if you do choose a cause, there's the further question of how do you decide which charity, say again, if we go back to global poverty, there are many charities doing different things to help people in global poverty. So there's a separate issue about how do you evaluate those organizations.
And in terms of choosing the cause, I mean, how much of that is personal preference? There are calculations you can do. You can say, okay, go to science and say, what are the chances an asteroid will fatally impact the planet? And okay, that's, of course, even then you got to say, okay, then that's no human beings for an infinite number of generations. That's a tough thing to factor into an equation. Yeah. Or maybe it's an easy thing. Maybe that's actually it's hard because then you're multiplying the likelihood times infinity. Anyway, this gives some sense of how complicated these things can get. And, you know, with global warming, there's a wide range of models. And then, you know, so how much of that initial question, well, I'm going to focus on this cause, do you kind of concede just has to be a matter of personal preference? Or are you arguing that, no, you can be and should be rigorous even at that stage?
I'm arguing that there probably is a right answer to that question, but that it's very difficult to calculate the right answer because we would need a lot of information that we don't have. I mean, sometimes it's just factual information. How bad will climate change be? Also, how likely is it that my contribution to fighting climate change will make any difference, and what kind of difference? So those are factual questions. With the question that we talked about wiping out the species, which effective altruists refer to as existential risk, there's a philosophical question, and that is, do you factor in the loss of those future lives that won't come into existence at all because we've been wiped out? Or do you just say, well, this is a disaster because it kills 7 billion people, and that's terrible, but the fact that these other people, you know, vastly greater numbers of billions of trillions of whatever people mm-hmm. will never come into existence, how does that weigh? So there's a philosophical conundrum there that philosophers have been debating for a few years, but there's no
seems
really
to me you've
clear.
Got to give some weight to the unborn, of course that's a question that in turn has all kinds of applications to, for example, abortion and so on. But anyway, it seems to me that if you're a utilitarian, and we'll, maybe we should actually stop and spell out your own philosophical framework for looking at this, and in a way, in a certain sense, the motivation for all this. You are a utilitarian. Do you have a one-sentence description of what a utilitarian is for people who don't know?
Sure. A utilitarian is somebody who thinks that the right action is the one that produces the best consequences. And typically by best consequences, utilitarians mean the highest level of well-being. So, you know, the classic utilitarians talked about pleasure and pain, maximizing pleasure, minimizing pain, increasing the surplus of pleasure over pain or of happiness over misery. That's broadly what utilitarianism is. But let me just say, it's certainly true that I'm a utilitarian. It's also true that if you're a utilitarian, I think it's clear that you ought to be an effective altruist. The converse doesn't hold. I think you can be an effective altruist without being a utilitarian. You can say, look, I think that in general, it is important to reduce suffering or to improve welfare or to stop kids dying prematurely. But I'm not a utilitarian because I think there are some things that it's absolutely wrong to do no matter what the consequences. You know, for example, well, Dostoevsky's famous question, right? I wouldn't torture an innocent child even if that was going to achieve utopia on Earth forever. I guess a utilitarian will say, well, if that really was going to achieve utopia on Earth forever, I would torture an innocent child. But you could be an effective altruist because fortunately, without being a utilitarian, because fortunately, you don't have to torture innocent children to create utopia. In fact, it doesn't help. So you know, you can have these rules and say, I'll never violate these rules. But as long as I'm not violating these rules, then sure, I want to make people happier, reduce suffering, and so on.
Yeah, and just as an asterisk, we should say there's a distinction between act-based utilitarianism and rule-based utilitarianism, and the latter gives you a reason to actually answer no sometimes to questions like should you torture a baby, but we won't get into that, but it's there is that option to be a so-called rule-based utilitarian,
sure.
and that that may help you out of becoming a very unpopular utilitarian at dinner parties and stuff. I know that's how I use it. Okay, so anyway, what I was going to say was that utilitarianism seems to presuppose that human welfare is a good thing. So you'd think that if the comet is going to prevent a lot of human welfare that would have otherwise happened in the future, you'd think you'd count that in. But you're saying it's a controversial issue even among utilitarians.
It is. There are different views on it, yeah. I mean, it seems to me, I agree, that you ought to count it in. But other people say, no, we're concerned about the welfare of beings who exist or who will exist independently of any decisions we make. Mm-hmm. We're not concerned about merely potential ones.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are these realms where the calculations are simpler and less conjectural. As you mentioned, there's, you know, we know how much money it takes to cure or in some cases, I guess, prevent blindness. We know how much it costs to save lives in the case of certain kinds of diseases. Is that, you know, there are these organizations now, for example, GiveWell, which assesses charitable causes and advises people on what the most efficient ones are. They have a website, givewell.something, and you can go and see what their favorite charities are. Are they confining their analysis to these more readily quantifiable sectors?
Yeah, if you go to givewell.org and you look at their top charities, they are definitely limiting themselves to ones where they can quantify what the charity is doing and roughly at what cost. So what cost is it saving a life, or is it doing some other good thing, keeping poor kids at school, for example. So in that sense, it's a fairly narrow selection of charities that they end up recommending. It's mostly charities that do one thing, because that's then easier to assess. So Against Malaria Foundation distributes bed nets to prevent malaria, and you can quantify how many lives are saved by that, because you have some villages where there are bed nets that have been distributed, and you have other villages where they haven't got to yet and there are no bed nets. And you can look at that, and you can look at the costs of distributing the bed nets. So you can quantify that quite readily. And that's a simple example. There's an organization that gives money, cash grants, directly to poor families, again, in East Africa. And you can look at what they do with the money. You can look at how much better off those very poor families that receive the money are a year or so later than the ones that didn't receive it. Again, it's a fairly narrow thing. There's charities that deworm kids, that give them treatments to get rid of their intestinal parasites. You can look at how much difference that makes to how long they stay at school. Because the parasites sap their energy, they do better at school and so on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, these are quite simple. And the bigger, more diverse organizations, the Oxfams and World Vision and CARE and Save the Children, don't actually get recommended by GiveWell. Not because they're not doing good work. GiveWell just says, we can't really evaluate them. They do too many different things. We can't track everything they do. We can't say what a dollar you gave to Oxfam would actually do, because, you know, money is fungible. And if they get more money for one thing, they'll put it into something that's underfunded and so on. So I think people should treat GiveWell as a source for finding charities where you can have a high level of confidence and a high level of rigor that they are doing something good with your money. And the others are not necessarily worse, but they're more speculative, or they haven't been able to provide that kind of clear, demonstrable evidence that GiveWell is looking for.
Okay. Now, it seems to me there, in principle, an emphasis on effective altruism could, partly for the reason we're now touching on, lead to a kind of misallocation of philanthropic resources. And here's what I mean. Well, in simple terms, I mean toward the more, a shift of resources toward the more readily quantifiable, away from the less readily quantifiable. But the example I'd give is, you know, a peril that I think is underrated, although it's certainly acknowledged, is just kind of hatred, conflict between ethnicities, between nations, and so on. And the reason I think it's underrated is because it is often characterized by a positive feedback kind of spiral, such that, you know, it gets worse, and that makes it get worse. So, like, you know, 9/11 happens, the United States says something arguably ill-advised that makes the problem worse, then we react to the worsening of the problem in an equally unwise way, and it gets worse, and so on. This kind of conflict is often characterized by that. So I personally think, by that kind of positive feedback dynamic, I personally think this is kind of underrated. At the same time, it's very hard to figure out what to do about it exactly. I mean, I would say harder in philanthropic terms than in policy terms, in a way. And I know one thing you get into is like, well, how effective is policy advocacy as a form of altruism? But anyway, leaving that aside, just focusing on this question of hatred and violence, it's hard for me to imagine. I mean, I suspect that some of these NGOs are doing good work that is productive, that at least increases the likelihood of favorable resolution of these problems, maybe seeds of peace or something, who knows. At the same time, I've got to think, it's almost impossible to even start quantifying the potential gain of these things. You know, something like seeds of peace, for example. If you're trying to foster goodwill among young people of rival ethnicities, I don't know how you put that in the calculator. And then the larger question is there a danger of people, if they become too focused on effective altruism, shifting all the resources into the relatively clear-cut cases?
Okay, so like the second part of that first, yeah, there is some danger about that. But effective altruism, as we've been talking about, is an emerging new movement, but it's still a small movement. And I think there's, for the foreseeable future, there are going to be other people who are not effective altruists but are interested in philanthropy. And so I hope effective altruism will divert a significant portion of philanthropic funds to the more highly effective charities. And I think that will do a lot of good. And perhaps it will divert them away from the ones we were talking about before, the very high-level donations to the arts and so on. In terms of the kind of thing that you mentioned, I agree that that is a huge global problem that we ought to be trying to do something about. But effective altruists would say, well, show me something that is really working, right? Where is the evidence that an organization has gone into an area, done something, and then what looked like it was going to threaten into a horrible, violent, ethnic hatred situation calmed down and people started living peacefully together again. You know, now, if you can do that and if you can show that for expenditure of X, we can have a certain chance, you can't say more than probability, but a probability of reducing violent conflict that will take a significant number of lives, then we could, you know, effective altruists could start to consider this.
Right, but I guess one thing I'm suggesting is that in some areas, direct intervention is just a less plausible thing, in part because the actual interventions are controlled by governmental bodies, but also maybe also by nature of the problem, so that the most you could hope to do is maybe a certain kind of consciousness raising, say among both Israelis and Palestinians, make them better at seeing each other's why, you know, the two hold these perspectives and have these tendencies and so on, you know, putting themselves in each other's shoes, not in the sense of feeling their pain, but seeing their perspective. You know, that might do good, but there's no way you're going to be able to trace the influence by which it does good, if it does, right? So...
yeah. Well, that's a problem, I guess. That is a problem for anyone, isn't it? To know, yeah. You don't have to be an effective altruist to say, well, here's this organization that says we can help Palestinians and Israelis to see each other's perspectives. But if you don't know where they actually are helping, you know, maybe they organize football matches or something like that, where they play each other and they fraternize after the game. And so now you have, you know, a few hundred Palestinian and Israeli youths who play with each other and talk about each other's perspective. But, you know, you might be able to attribute that to the organization that organized the games, but then does that have any impact on the overall situation between Israelis and Palestinians? Does it reduce the likelihood of further violence? It's really hard to know, isn't it? But without knowing that, it is hard to know whether that's worth supporting.
Right. And I think some problems, that's in the nature of some kinds of problems. It's hard to trace the influence. So speaking of... the distinction I just made between feeling people's pain and just putting yourself in their shoes in a different sense, just seeing their perspective. There's a variety of motivations that could lead to altruism or that could lead to charitable giving or these good works, right? And I gather you're not too judgmental about what the motivation is, right? I mean, there are people who split hairs about what is and isn't altruism. Depending on what exactly motivated it, what you felt when you were doing it, was there anything in any sense self-serving about it? You don't really care, right?
No, I don't really care. I mean, I am, you know, more interested in the consequences and what happens. And in particular, I suppose, you know, look, sure, you don't praise people particularly if they do things that are purely self-serving. So if somebody jumps into the surf and rescues a drowning child, your first reaction is, oh, they're a hero. And then you learn that they knew that the child was the child of a billionaire and they were doing it only because they were rewarded. On another occasion, they'd let a child drown because the child was poor or had no assets or whatever. You know, obviously, then you think very differently about them. But if somebody says, for example, look, I'm involved in effective altruism because it makes me feel good to know that I'm making a positive difference to the world. It makes me feel good to know that I'm reducing suffering. And it makes my life more rewarding, more fulfilling. And I think that that's better than whatever else I could have done with the money. That wouldn't have made me feel that good if I'd, you know, upgraded my car to a more prestigious brand or something like that. That's fine with me. I think it's terrific that people should feel good because they know they're doing good in the world. And for somebody to say, well, they're not really an altruist because they didn't make a sacrifice. They didn't really want that BMW or Porsche or whatever. And they feel better having provided bed nets for kids in Africa. So they're not an altruist. I mean, you know, that's that's not the kind of world we want. We don't want a world in which people are feeling, oh, it's such a heavy burden I've got to bear, but I just have to do my duty. That's a kind of Kantian viewpoint more than a utilitarian one, I suppose. Utilitarians would like there to be a harmony between self-interest and everybody's interest.
Right, and even if you're a Kantian, mightn't it be the case that reading Kant has made you feel so guilty about not doing the good thing that you'll actually feel better if you did it? I mean, isn't it almost always the case that when people do things we call good, there is, at some level, an egoistic kind of payoff?
I suppose if you think that relieving the burden of guilt is an egoistic payoff, then... you might say that, yes, that's possible. But otherwise, you would have felt you were violating your duty, to put this in Kantian terms, not following the categorical imperative or something like that. So perhaps you're right. There has to be some kind of motivation of some sort. And instead of talking about egoism versus self-sacrifice, we should be talking about whether, in fact, you are intending to help others some way, and that should be enough to make you an altruist.
Okay. And there is some discussion in your book about the connection between doing good things and happiness, right? About the psychological payoff. What is the literature on that saying?
So my reading is that the literature is now building up quite impressively in all sorts of different ways to show that people who do help others are more satisfied with their lives, so generally happier, and that this is not just a correlation. It's not just that happy people do more to help others, but there is research that suggests a cause and effect. So, for example, you take volunteers, give all of them a sum of money, you know, maybe $50 or $100, and at random you pick half of them and you say, here's some money, go out and spend it on yourself and come back at the end of the day and tell us what you did with it. And the others, you say, here's some money, go out and spend it on somebody else or do something good with it and come back at the end of the day and tell us what you did. And then as well as getting them back at the end of the day to tell them what they did, they're asked to rate how much they liked the day, how good do they feel about the moment, you know, what sort of mood are they in, did they enjoy the day? And those that were told to do something good for others tend to say that they enjoyed the day more. So that clearly suggests causation there. And there's also neuroimaging studies, which, invite people to choose to either buy something for themselves or give it away when they're having their brain scanned. And those who are giving it away, you have more activity in the reward centers of the brain, the parts of the brain that light up when we have delicious food or great sex. So, again, that does suggest causation, not just correlation.
And what does your own experience suggest? I mean, you more than most, do give away a big chunk of your income. And more than that, you've spent pretty much your whole career trying to convince people to do good. Just introspectively, what would you say is your motivation?
I certainly like to think that I'm part of what I would say, you know, the tradition of the good guys in the world, the people who, you know, you can go back a long way, and I do particularly identify with the English utilitarians like Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill, and so on. These were people who were reformers, they were enlightened, they were trying to reduce cruelty and suffering in the world, and it goes back, you know, long before that, of course, too. So I guess I like to be identified with that. I feel good about myself because I think I can identify with people who are trying to make the world a better place. And that's really important for me. And I also think it's true that I doubt that the sort of things that I could have bought or spent my money on if I hadn't given any away would have made a significant difference to my life. I mean, you know, a lot of these things don't really mean very much to me, going out to very fancy restaurants, whatever. I think you can enjoy a meal just as much that doesn't cost very much. And, you know, as long as my car gets me from A to B, I don't really care much more about what it's like. I don't really think that I've missed out on important things. And on the other hand, as I said, I think I've gained quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's also a related to the literature we've talked about, there's a literature on the extent to which increasing your surely material gains does or does not increase your happiness. It's kind of part of the same literature, broadly speaking. Having looked into that, would you say that if you were the kind of person who really valued a nice new car, great meal, would it still be the case that actually the way the hedonic machinery in our brains work, you'd be just about as well off giving the money away? Or you know, in other words, are these people just on the so-called hedonic treadmill?
I think that's what the evidence suggests pretty much, that when you get the new car, you feel good about it. And when you're particularly focusing on it, you know, when you're admiring it parked in your garage or, you know, thinking about what a great machine it is, you know, then maybe it makes you feel positive. But most of the time you're not thinking about that and it's not that relevant. So you need something else new. You keep needing to move up, I think. That's the treadmill idea that you referred to, I suppose. You need to keep running to stay in the same place. Mm-hmm. And I think that is different from the people who are living more altruistically and getting a kind of an internal reward, which I think doesn't require that sort of running. You know, mm-hmm. It's not as if I feel I have to keep giving more in order to be just as satisfied with what I'm doing and what I'm living, how I'm living. Mm-hmm. Whereas it does seem that with the material satisfaction, it's a short-term burst that it gives you, and then you do need to move on and do something else. And, you know, maybe that's why so many people really seem to be kind of compulsive shoppers and keep acquiring more stuff, even though they're not using it. There's all these studies that show that although Americans have more living space per capita than they ever had before, because typically the houses are getting bigger and the families are getting smaller, the storage industry is still booming. They have so much stuff that they can't fit it into their larger houses. And they have to store it off site, or they put it in their garage, and they don't have room to put their car in their garage anymore. I think you know, there is that pretty much compulsive tendency. Again, not with everybody, but it certainly affects a segment of the population.
So if it's true that actually material acquisition doesn't make us happier to speak of, by and large, and doing good things actually does make us happier, if those two things are true, I mean, could that almost make you revise the premise of that original paper of yours we talked about? In other words, the premise was, as I give money away, I am sacrificing welfare, right? That was the framework of that paper. As I give money away, I am sacrificing welfare. And the question is, you know, at what point do I have so little welfare left that even an ultimate altruist does not give any more away? But what you're suggesting now is giving is a non-zero-sum game.
That's certainly true, and I guess you're right. I didn't take that into account in the early paper. The only thing that could be said about that is that the research about consumption and happiness in the hedonic treadmill assumes that you do have, let's say, you know, a sufficiency. It's typically, I think, a lot of the studies suggest that as your income increases up to about $70,000 US, mm-hmm. For in the US, your level of happiness does rise. And it's at that point that it starts to flatten out. There's some debate as to whether it then goes completely flat or whether it just goes up much, much more slowly. But, you know, so I guess you could still say, once, if I were to get below that $70,000 level, which I haven't, then maybe I would be starting to have some kind of sacrifice for the benefits that I'm conferring on others.
Okay, and I guess kind of in closing, well, I guess I have two quick questions. One is, do we know which is the more common motivation for giving? Empathy in the sense of like really feeling their pain, you know, emotional empathy, as opposed to a more almost rational process by which you just realize, well, whoa, they could be, that person could be better off, whether or not you actually feel their pain and are made uncomfortable by their distress. Do we know which is the more common motivator?
Yeah, I think if we're talking about the more common motivator with a larger number of people, it is the emotional pull, the empathy or something like that. That is clearly the majority of donors. They may tend to be smaller donors. It may be that once you go up to the larger donors, there is more, if you like, rational thinking about how much good I could do. Mm-hmm. There's a study that I remember that where a large charity allowed researchers to insert more data about the effect of the programs and how it was benefiting people. Mm-hmm. And they mailed that out to all their supporters. And among those supporters who had typically donated less than $100, adding that data actually reduced the response they got. Whereas among supporters who typically donated more than $100, it increased the response. But, you know, the majority of supporters for a popular charity probably do donate $100 or less, although the majority of the money raised probably comes from people who donate $100 or more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe I'll leave it there. We've covered a lot. Let me again show people what the Kindle version would look like on their smartphone. It would look just like that. The most good you can do, how effective altruism is changing ideas about living ethically. And it's an actual movement, effective altruism, that people can join and become happier by joining. Is that right?
And make others happier too.
Yes.
As you win, say, win. Non-zero.
Win-win. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much, Peter. And maybe next, you write books frequently enough that maybe if you come back next time you write one, it won't be too long. And if you want to come back before that, you're certainly welcome.
Thanks very much, Bob. Good to talk to you.
Take care.